Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, you're listening to the FlixWise podcast. I know what you are, but what am I? I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today is the editor of ClassicFilmFan.com, assistant professor at La Sierra University. She's a loner, she's a rebel, she's Miss Carrie Specht.
Hiya.
And I wouldn't trade my next guest for all the money in the world, not for 100 million, trillion, billion dollars. Coming at us from Toronto, Canada, is filmmaker, cinephile, and now co-producer of FlixWise, Mr. Martin Kessler.
Hello, and if you have any information leading to the whereabouts of my bicycle, please get in touch with me after this podcast.
I know what you listeners are thinking. Now, Lady P, your intro appears to be referencing a certain famous 1985 Tim Burton movie, but I don't remember seeing Pee-wee's Big Adventure on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. Well, unfortunately, you're correct. It didn't quite make the cut. However, the movie that Pee-wee's Big Adventure is based on, Vittorio De Sica's Bicycle Thieves, landed in the 33rd place on the list. Today, we're going to talk about the historical significance of Bicycle Thieves and other Italian neorealist films. And we're going to discuss whether or not 33 is an appropriate place for it to stand. Next up, no, it's not dusty in here. And we certainly aren't chopping onions. Those are, in fact, tears in our eyes, because our second topic is about movies that make us cry. Bicycle Thieves is a sad movie, to be sure, but is it a tearjerker? If not, what is the distinction? We shall discuss. Finally, we're going to regain our composure for a few final notes of positivity. All right, so you guys got your Kleenex ready?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Okay, all right, let's do this.
First of all, you just blew my mind.
Yeah.
I had no idea that Pee-wee Herman's
yeah.
Big Adventure
was based on...
I had no idea.
What?
It never occurred to me.
You will have a whole new appreciation for that film now.
Totally.
Yeah.
I have to go back and watch it.
All right. First up, it's the 33rd greatest movie of all time, according to the Sight and Sound Critics poll. Vittorio De Sica's 1948 Italian neorealist classic, Bicycle Thieves. The film takes place in post-World War II Rome, well before the so-called Italian economic miracle brought on by the Marshall Plan, a time when most of Europe was beset with massive structural and economic problems. But this story is a simple one, really. A man named Antonio Ricci is desperate to feed his hungry, poverty-stricken family. But then again, so it seems is everyone in the city. Antonio is one of thousands of unemployed men searching for a job, any job. But the beginning of the film starts with something of a minor miracle. A position opens up for a man who can go around the city pasting movie posters on every street corner. The catch is, the position requires that this man have a bicycle. Now, Antonio has a bike, however, it's in hock. But not to be deterred, Antonio takes the job, and his very patient, understanding wife pawns their bedsheets to get the bike back. All seems to be looking out for the Ricci family as Antonio goes off for his first day on the job. That is until a young man sneaks up on Antonio and steals his precious bicycle. The rest of the film follows Antonio and his young son Bruno as they desperately scour the city looking for their stolen property and their salvation. Will Antonio find the bike, save his job, and recover his dignity? If you know anything about Italian neorealism, I bet you can guess the answer to that question. If you don't know anything about Italian neorealism, well, listen up, because we're about to talk about it. So, do you like Bicycle Thieves? Carrie, let's start with you.
I love this film.
Okay.
I love, love, love this film. I saw it when I was in junior college, actually. So at the ripe age of 18 or 19 in a film appreciation class. This is before I was a film major, though I pretty much knew I was going to be. And I was introduced to it as the Bicycle Thief, because I believe back in the 80s, that's how people interpreted the translation
right.
of the title. And man, just the story of the desperation, the sense of trying to achieve a sense of pride mm-hmm. through having a position, the support of the family, and the love between the father and the son mm-hmm. is just amazing.
Martin, how about you?
I really like Bicycle Thieves. I think, like you said, it's a simple story, but it packs a lot of dramatic punch. And that relationship between the father and son at the center of it, that's what really, I think, makes me respond to the film.
Where do you stand on the Bicycle Thief versus Bicycle Thieves? We should say that it was originally translated, or the title in the States has been The Bicycle Thief. And then somewhere along the line, we discovered that was sort of a mistranslation in the Italian. It's more correct to say Bicycle Thieves, but do you have a preference?
I think I'm used to saying Bicycle Thieves just because that's how it was introduced to the film and how most people I know
yeah.
address it. But I do kind of like Bicycle Thief as a title because you can play the whole who's the real Bicycle Thief game.
Right, right, exactly. Not to mention it's giving something away, right? Or is it the we're all bicycle thieves, with the plural?
There's a bicycle thief inside all of us.
Exactly. When it's the singular, it almost seems like it's referring to Antonio.
The dad.
Yeah, the dad. Yeah.
That's the way I always interpret yeah, it. Because, yeah. I mean, yeah, I've always thought of him as the thief. But there is that question of, I at that time in the city, were they all? And maybe that's why it's a plural.
Right. We're all capable of we're all capable of that desperation, and we're all capable of doing horrible things, I guess. If
well,
it is thieves.
Horrible.
Well, not horrible.
Depending
but,
on your
you
point
know,
of view.
Yeah. I mean, but it was what happened to Antonio was horrible.
Right.
You know.
And then do you do a horrible act?
Right.
In retaliation
right,
to help
or
your
just
family.
Out of desperation. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, it's a powerful question. In addition to being just a really emotional story, I think the larger implications of what he does in the end are pretty profound beyond just being a really sad, bleak movie.
Well, at the time, too, though, when it was made, Italy had no idea what their future was.
Right.
You know, so you have somebody who's an artist, the filmmaker, saying, we don't know what's going to happen here. This is the reality.
Right.
We're not going to make a nice packed Hollywood ending.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's classic studio ending. This is neorealism, which is usually stark.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And well, let's talk about some of the signifiers. How do we know that we're watching an Italian neorealist film? Obviously, there's the depiction of poverty usually, and the defining trait often is that it's shot outside, which is the major contrast to the Hollywood films of the era.
Yeah, no sets and sort of an unromanticized approach to the real locations. Like, I don't think there's any shots that, you know, the tourism board would want to borrow. I think it's trying to give you a very direct look at the outside, at the reality of the city.
Right, right.
And I think also usually there's a sense that government oppression,
mm-hmm.
even though the World War is over,
mm-hmm.
They have a new government who's coming in and controlling, and they still have this sense of having to fall in line, having to not get in trouble,
mm-hmm.
being afraid of the authorities.
Right, right. Absolutely. Yeah. And I can't remember if Rome Open City is on the list. I have to imagine that it is. And that's a depiction of life during the fascist regime, basically.
The Germans are just leaving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. And another really famous one, Germany Year Zero. That one is so bleak. It's, again, is this a thing that...
So neorealism is really... if you're depressed, do not watch a neorealist
Goodness.
Film.
Well, I think some of them can be kind of uplifting, too. I think Paisan, which Rossellini did, has some uplifting moments in it. I
think Bicycle Thief does,
yeah.
too.
Yeah, at the end, it's all relative, really. Like, Bicycle Thief is... it's very sad, but compared to Germany Year Zero, it's practically, you know...
Uplifting,
yeah.
Disney's new realism.
Yeah, exactly. yeah, De Sica was heavily influenced by Charlie Chaplin. You do get the sense that the ending is a lot like modern times, where things are bleak, but they're going to go on. They're going to keep being bleak, and we're just going to keep living. So it's hopeful in that sense. Like,
well, this
life
is life.
Goes on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Life is kind of miserable, but we'll make the best of it.
Mm-hmm.
So when I think of the movie, I usually think the ending is the part where the father tries to steal the bike and fails. But it's almost uplifting when he starts crying and the son grabs his hand and
mm-hmm.
they cry together.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny that there's something almost hopeful in that moment. And you do get a sense with the final moments of the film that it's going to be okay.
Well, again, like you said, we're going to do it together.
Right, exactly.
I you probably have heard that all of the actors were,
mm-hmm.
they're non-actors.
Right.
The wife was a lawyer. The kid was an urchin on the street.
Right, they just found
that
him.
That kid is amazing.
I know.
He's like one of the best child actors ever. When he's crying and yelling at his dad, it's
mm-hmm.
like, oh my gosh, this is like a little man
mm-hmm.
that's like performing here. He's got such maturity in his emotions. And then when the father thinks that, okay, I'm sorry, another spoiler, thinks that his son is drowned. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That is one of the most gut-wrenching moments. It's equivalent. You said he was influenced by Chaplin. It's equivalent to that moment in The Kid, mm-hmm. when they try to take the kid away from the
Tramp.
The tramp.
Yeah.
Thank you. Oh my gosh. I have to give back my classic film card. It's so real.
Mm-hmm.
And it's anybody who's had any relationship with a parent or a child can totally relate, mm-hmm. in that moment.
Yeah.
If you don't get neorealism, that's fine. You'll get that moment.
Yeah.
And you'll get the relationship between the father and the son.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, my favorite scene in the whole film actually is the one that comes right after that, when they sort of go to the restaurant, and it's almost a relief from the unrelenting unfairness of the movie, and he probably spends more money than he should, and it's this nice little bubble from the rest of the world. But also in that scene too, you see the difference between the main characters and the other people in the restaurant, just in the way they're dressed, in the way their faces are, how they eat. You see that there's such a big gap between the people that can afford to go there and our heroes, and he's sort of dreaming of, if I get my bike back, we'll be able to eat here, and our lives will be so much easier.
Because the whole film, it's nothing but poverty. That seems like the default.
Well, and that, like you said earlier, they pawn their sheets.
Right.
And one of the things I love about that scene is that you see that the wall is stacked from floor to ceiling with other people's sheets.
Right.
That everybody pawns their sheets.
Right.
And it's like, I don't think a pawn broker would take somebody's sheets now.
Right, exactly.
But that the fact that, what else do you have to give besides the clothes off on your back?
Right, right.
You know, and in... It's amazing to think that this is what people are driven to,
mm-hmm.
in this incredible moment of poverty that's nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a visually stunning moment to really hit home that point of how poor these people are.
Right, right, right. And the other guy tries to pawn the binoculars. Every item you have, anything that can get sold.
Yeah.
will be pawned. We need food.
Right.
And like I said, this came out in 1948. And 1948 was the year of the Marshall Plan. And just shortly after the Marshall Plan took hold, Italy experienced an economic boom.
Yeah, there's such a huge difference between the world that this film is showing and then the world that Italian films in the late 50s, early 60s are showing. Like, it's completely different.
Right, yeah. I just think about this film and other neorealist films compared to, say, La Dolce Vita.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Such a stark contrast.
Well, and all the other, they did a bunch of Sand and Sandals films and biblical films. And the extreme difference was either they were doing neorealism or they were doing these really glossy, you know, Hercules type films.
Right, right. And this film is sort of different from other Italian neorealism films. Rossellini and De Sica are intentionally going for the sort of documentary effect. It's supposed to look like it's shot like you're just out on the street, everyday life, cinema verite style. But this, it's sort of misleading because there was a budget for this, and it's actually more of a Hollywood film. It's not a Hollywood film, but it's higher budget.
What was the budget?
I'm not sure what the exact figure was, but they had money for background. They actually had a rain machine, so.
Oh, well.
it's meant to give the effect of, you know, man on the street just shooting everyday life. That is, in fact, sort of,
an artifice.
Say, yeah,
well,
exactly.
Well, it can take a lot of effort and money to make things look unstaged.
It's amazing.
It's easy.
Yeah.
Well, I was wondering too if that style, that almost documentary-like style, if that really helps sell the heightened drama, because I was thinking about there are these Italian melodramas that have also very heightened emotion and big dramatic scenes, but for some reason they don't hit me as hard, and I'm wondering if that's because the style that Bicycle Thief is done in lets you accept these bigger emotions as being real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because this film is certainly very melodramatic.
Here's the interesting thing about that term melodramatic is that it has such a bad reputation.
Right.
But actually, when melodramas are done right, they're quite effective.
Absolutely.
Well, sure. Like, I love Douglas Sirk melodrama.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Well, but you know, the kid going on and being hysterical is fantastic melodrama, but it's, oh my gosh, it's like really good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just most of the plot points in the movie are so bleak. And a series of really horrible things happen. It certainly is melodramatic. Like, in real life, this is certainly possible that this series of events could happen. You could have this horrible string of bad luck. But the way that it's presented, I'd certainly say it's melodramatic.
Right.
You know, it's not presented as matter of fact.
No, and I'm sort of thinking that because it's done in that style, it lets us buy into the melodrama and sort of forget that it is so heightened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's true. Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's why a lot of filmmakers use this style to make their films seem bleaker than they would otherwise be.
Maybe it was Lars von Trier talking about Breaking the Waves, where he said that if he didn't shoot it in that particular style with the handheld camera and that very natural sort of feel, people wouldn't accept the story because it's so out there and so over the top emotionally in some ways.
Right.
I think it's probably a similar thing with the Italian neorealist style.
Exactly. I sometimes feel like there's something kind of dishonest in the so-called aesthetics of poverty. As you say, it is an artifice. It is, you chose to shoot it this way. But it is, it's a manipulation. It's a means of manipulating.
Well,
which is fine, but all film.
You're also casting a lawyer as his poor wife.
Right.
So, you know. Whether or not she was actually unemployed, I'm sure she wasn't that hard off.
Right, right.
You know, and in any of these actors, the real people acting, they came to an audition.
Right.
So it's not like he just literally plucked them off the street.
Right.
Except, I think, the boy.
Yeah. You got a nice face, kid. Yeah. but it doesn't, I don't think it's trying to suggest necessarily that this is anything but a movie. There are elements of real life, but it's not, you know, it's not actually a documentary. And definitely you can see the Hollywood influence here.
But when you say Hollywood in this case, do you mean just a formal type of filmmaking? So, a structured form of filmmaking, is that what you mean by Hollywood influence? Or are you talking about being influenced by the filmmakers of Hollywood?
I guess I'm specifically talking about the score and how he uses the score to underline and punctuate emotions.
Like, I think like the two things I sort of didn't quite like about the film, one was the score I thought maybe sold a little bit too hard. And there's the scene right before he steals the bicycle at the end where he's seeing all these shots of bicycles and there's bicycles driving by and it just feels too
formalist,
or it feels like a bit much for me. Just
like,
of course, he's surrounded by all these bicycles at the climax. Like, he can't just. I thought it would have been enough that he just makes the decision to steal one. We know how desperate he is at that point.
Yeah.
Well, yes and no. I mean, here he is, like you said, a series of unfortunate events, and it's like suddenly it's like when we all have a car that we want to buy, right? Suddenly, we start seeing that thing everywhere.
Yeah.
It's like there aren't any more of those cars out there. We just happen to be noticing them more.
Yeah.
So this is the one thing he really needs and he can't have. And he feels like he's surrounded by them.
Yeah.
So why doesn't he just reach out and take one?
Yeah.
But that's a very expressive moment. I don't think it totally fits with the style of the rest of the film. Like, I think that moment would work better in a different type of movie.
Yeah. But I think that's the point, is that he really did. I understand what you're saying, but I really think that was the point, is that it's not supposed to fit.
Interesting. I like the scene just after all the bikes go by so much, where he's pacing against that empty wall, just contemplating taking it. And the shot is divided by like a lamppost. And I always notice when there's a lamppost in the middle of a shot, and it's like he's in the beginning of the scene, he's on one side of the lamppost and the bike is on the other, and he's pacing on the one side and then he crosses over and takes the bike. I was like, that's the composition on that shot is so great. And that's sort of, on the one hand, it's beautiful. I thought it's an amazing shot. It's an amazing scene. But on the other hand, it's so cinematic. And so the idea that it's in any way a documentary or sort of tears down the artifice. But maybe, I don't know. I don't want to put words in his mouth because while it's supposed to depict real life, there are expressionists parts, and that's fine. There's no,
well, let's be he's a filmmaker. Yeah. He's trying to make money.
Exactly.
So yes, it's a neorealism, but he's not to the point of saying I don't care if nobody comes to see this film, because that would actually defeat the purpose.
Right But I think as in later film movements that were certainly influenced by this, like I'm thinking of Cinema Novo, the shot becomes harsher and it's almost like it becomes harder and harder to watch. And this film is still, while it's very bleak, it's still very aesthetically pleasing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
And that's not a knock against it, certainly. Like, I'm not saying it should be uglier. But it's just interesting to see how this realism evolved and how it took hold in other places.
Well, yeah, to put it a little more context here, I believe that audiences of the day did find it hard to watch. Mm-hmm. Because if you had gone too far to the extreme, which I don't think in his mind he would even have considered, then you wouldn't have anybody watching it. But this was to the extreme enough for American audiences, mm-hmm. that, it was difficult for them to watch this. It was difficult enough. He didn't need to do more.
And I can't imagine how refreshing this must have been to audiences in the late 40s. This feels so different from other films that were being made. It does feel like quite a breakthrough.
I mean, it made a huge splash. And in 1962, when Sight and Sound first conducted their poll, it was the number one film on the list.
Which is really interesting.
Yeah. And it has steadily dropped. I think the very next poll, and 10 years later, it dropped to like number six. And now it stands at number 33. So why do you think, what do you think is the reason for its decline in popularity?
Well, one would be there simply are more films being made.
I suppose so.
So that's going to affect a list of any kind.
That's true, but I think there aren't very many films on that are above it that were made after 1962. There are certainly, Apocalypse Now, the Godfather movies.
1952, it was a brand new movie. Like, it was a new film when it was voted to the number one spot, and I imagine people were very excited about it, and I think you also see a lot of films being influenced by it that I think might actually overtake it in people's minds, and we sort of maybe take it for granted and don't appreciate its influence as much as we might have when it was a brand new thing.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, you have a really good point. A lot of times, I personally am a huge, proponent of a definition for classic film being that they have to be at least 20 years or older. Because I think you need distance and time to really evaluate mm-hmm. the impact of a film. And what you've said about it is 62, it's still a relatively new film. It wouldn't have even been 20 years old. So people are still excited about it. And as time passes, there's more of an evaluation and its impact, as well as the other films that often get pushed to the side because of the newest thing that's out there. And then they realize, they being film critics and public at large, go, wait a second, that film that we pushed aside shouldn't be pushed aside for this newer one. We now realize, its impact is actually stronger, more lasting, mm-hmm. More influential. I think as time goes by, people really not only reevaluate that film that's ranked as number one, but all the other films, and go, oh, wait, there's something here that's influencing films today that we never saw before. Mm-hmm. And film, just like fashion, just like politics, is cyclical. Mm-hmm. So you see stuff come back around. And the styles and the influences and the approaches. Everything's old and it's new again. And you go back to a major film of the period or of that style, say, basically for neorealism, and that suddenly becomes a huge influence again. So who knows? Maybe it'll rise back up again.
As we
come back around to another new wave of filmmaking. Because with all these huge blockbusters that are out and all the superhero films that are out, there's going to be a big switch in the next couple of years, maybe 5 years, where suddenly we have simple stories again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I could see filmmakers wanting to, instead of this fantasy escapism, wanting to delve back into so-called real life, real stories. But let's talk a little bit more. We sort of addressed this, but What are some of the influences that this film had? Do you see aspects of this film in contemporary cinema?
Yeah, like I think there's countless films just coming up that seem directly influenced by this. And I think recently I saw a film called Siddharth. It's an Indian film about a father trying to find his son after he was maybe kidnapped from a sweatshop in India. And it's very similar in style and in storytelling.
Are you guys familiar with a film that came out a couple years ago that Damien Bashir was nominated for Best Actor, and it was called A Better Life?
I haven't seen it.
No, I haven't seen it.
It got overshadowed by The Artist. Mm-hmm. It was the same year. The film is so much like Bicycle Thief.
Yeah.
So much, because he's a poor immigrant, a workhand, mm-hmm. whose truck is stolen.
Same movie.
And he spends the rest of the film with his son, who doesn't want to be with him. That's the difference here. His son doesn't want to be with him.
All right. Well, then that begs the question, as I mentioned. 33rd on the Sight and Sound Critics poll as it currently stands. Do you think that is a good place for it? Would you put it higher? Would you put it lower? We always ask this question, so I will just tell you right off the bat that it is surrounded by Taxi Driver and The Godfather at 31 and The General and Psycho at 34th. What do you think, Martin?
I mean, honestly, I was actually a little bit dreading rewatching it because I hadn't seen it in maybe 5 or 6 years. And I was worried rewatching it, it wouldn't hold up. It was going to just be this big ball of schmaltz.
Yeah.
But I was really impressed just with how well it held up and how its simplicity didn't make it naive.
Mm.
So, like, I actually think 33 might be a little bit low for Bicycle Thief. It's so influential and it's held up clearly for over half a century now. So I think, it seems like more top 25 territory to
all
me.
Right.
I would agree. Absolutely. I would have expected it to be in the top 25, if not the top 15.
Okay. Wow. Top 15. Goodness. Okay. Yeah, I think it's low. I don't know about top 15, but I think it's due for a reevaluation. I'll never forget the time in my very first college film history course when the professor proclaimed to the class that if you did not cry at the end of Bicycle Thief, you have no heart. Now, that assertion may or may not be true, but since our previous topic was De Sica's classic tearjerker, I thought this would be a good time to talk about other movies that function as effective sociopath detectors. We're going to talk about what specifically it is about certain films that trigger the waterworks, and we're going to try to keep it together long enough to list off some of our personal favorites. So let's start with Carrie. Do movies often make you cry?
The older I get,
the more sentimental you become. Yeah. You get becoming on a softie.
Yeah, and I don't know. I don't really consider myself a sentimentalist, and I wasn't, I'm going to sound so old when I was your age. Mm-hmm. When I was fresh out of college, you know, it didn't really work. I'd watch films, I'd see other people cry, it would affect them, blah, blah, blah. But I'm not saying that 20-somethings and 30-somethings aren't, but I think if you aren't, the older you get, the more life you live, mm-hmm. then films will affect you more and more. And there are films that do it in a very real way that just evokes emotions. And then there are the films that manipulate the heck out of you.
Yeah.
And I get manipulated.
Yeah, it works.
Yeah.
Martin, how about you?
Yeah, I cry once in a while watching a movie. It's, yeah.
It's always a sports film though, right, Martin?
Yeah. it's probably not all that often where I catch myself crying a movie, but there's a few sort of go-to ones that I'll watch in private to let my emotions out once in a while.
I don't find myself crying when a movie is really unrelentingly sad.
You have no heart.
I have no heart. I have no heart.
Did you cry at the end of Bicycle Thief?
I did not, actually. I get a little weepy. I get a little teary-eyed, a little blurry-eyed, but I wasn't sobbing. I find that things that evoke...
Like most recently, yeah. what was the film that made you cry?
Okay, so the most recent film I watched that made me cry was Inside Out by Pixar.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet. But, you know, cartoons more often than not get me crying than a live-action film.
Yes, and I don't know why that is. I'm not sure what it is about it's often children's films mm-hmm. that
Iron
make
Man.
Me...
Oh my gosh.
Iron
Man.
Oh. Or you mean the Iron Giant?
Iron Giant. Oh, I always say that. Yeah. Iron Giant. Oh God. When he says Superman. Oh God. Every time.
That's one movie. If you don't cry at the Iron Giant, I don't know. There might be something wrong with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, definitely.
You might be a monster.
Sorry, Martin. Did
yeah.
you cry?
Yeah.
An Iron Giant?
Yeah.
Yeah. I. Okay. You stay, I go, no following. That's heartbreaking.
It sounded like you got a little emotional yeah. there, Martin.
There might be some voice cracks in this. But yeah, I'm trying to think. It's, again, that it's not that it's sad. It's that he's heroic. And that sort of stuff never used to get to me when I was younger. When I was a kid, yeah. it was always the sad stuff. It was dogs dying.
Well, it's
and
because of
cancer.
The emotional level, I think. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why I like Iron Giant, even though I keep calling it Iron Man by yeah. accident. So much was that it was this film that came out that really did reach so many different levels. It was great for kids. It was great for grownups. And that, for me, what made me so sad was that this character was reaching a goal that they were trying to attain. Mm-hmm. It's the whole Spock or Data trying to be more human
right.
and getting the opportunity to be more human
exactly.
and by sacrifice. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And that of course is the level for the adults and for the kids. So wait, he's going to get hurt.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So do you have specific triggers that get you every time?
Not specifically, though. I love, there's this one film. I don't know if you guys have ever seen the Gerard Depardieu version of Big Nose.
Pinocchio?
No.
Cyrano de Bergerac.
That was, what's his name? Italian dude, yeah. Roberto.
Gerard Depardieu's version of Pinocchio didn't get me, yeah. but his version of
Cyrano de Bergerac.
De Bergerac. Yeah. I was in college when I saw that. And I was sobbing so much, I couldn't read the subtitles.
Yeah.
I'm just like wiping the tears
yeah.
away.
Yeah.
It was, and I was home alone watching it. I was like, thank God, no one's saving yeah. me right now. Oftentimes now, again, because I'm older, didn't used to get to me when I was younger, parents with kids, like a really, especially adults, you know, some sort of either sudden understanding or revelation, then now I cry about that stuff that I didn't used to cry about.
Yeah.
When the parent is either not dying or finally says, I love you, or suddenly the toughness, the wall breaks down and there's a moment, and sometimes they don't even say it. It's just a look or a punch in the arm. And you just suddenly like, oh my gosh, this is yeah. the biggest emotional point. He can't, that's all he can do.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly. Yeah. Martin, how about you? Do you have any triggers, anything that will send you over the edge?
Well, I was thinking, like you said, back to the Iron Giant example, it's usually not something that's purely sad. It has to be maybe a little bit bittersweet
mm.
or have some, I don't know, positive emotion to it too, to really get me going.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
yeah.
You know, there's like Kieslowski films where I'm like, oh, that's so sad, but they won't make me cry.
Right, mm-hmm. exactly, yeah.
And
yeah.
I think like just seeing also characters on screen releasing their emotions, it's kind of like a little trigger that, okay, it's all right for me to let loose a little bit too, you know, even if it's Liam Neeson or Denzel Washington on screen, you see, like, oh, they're crying, it's okay for me to cry a little.
Yeah, I think, like, I mentioned in the previous segment, Germany Year Zero, I mean, that's among the bleakest films I've ever seen, mm-hmm. and I did not cry at all. It was too upsetting. I think I cry more when there's triumph. And mm-hmm. when it evokes imagination
mm-hmm.
and just like, yeah, it's triumph of the human spirit. It'll get me every time, every single time. So that's why movies about space, movies that take place in space always kill me.
Wow.
I know. Like, I don't like that I start tearing up at the end of Apollo 13, but I do.
But Interstellar, did that get you?
Not so much. Okay. No, okay. No. But but when Luke Skywalker looks up at the two suns and longs to escape the deserts of Tatooine, like, I'm gonna tear up. It's gonna happen. It's gonna happen.
See, I have a tendency to. This is like my male side.
Yeah.
End of Field of Dreams, you know,
yeah.
when Kevin Costner asks his dad, you want to
catch.
Want to have a catch. And he cracks his voice just a little.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. Stuff like that, you know, where
yeah.
there's that a male emotion that's just, just below the surface, mm-hmm. and you're like, oh, you totally know what's going on there, mm-hmm. even though they're not totally showing it.
Yeah, yeah.
Gets me every time.
Yeah. But is there really such a distinction between what makes men cry and what makes women cry? I guess we happen to have a man on the show who can answer, maybe help us answer that question.
What makes you cry, yes. Martin?
I mean, there are very masculine films that'll make me cry. Like, I was thinking of Ikihiro, the Kurosawa film.
Ah, yes, yes, yes.
Like, yeah, that's a very sort of manly, weepy film.
Yeah.
But
it's a dude weepy.
I think, like, there is maybe a little bit more of a stigma about men crying or letting out our emotions.
Right.
So I think sometimes, like, the masculine versions of weepies, we sort of have to, like, slip it, like you said, into a sports film or maybe into an action film. Something like Point Break, it's a very sort of masculine... weepy, basically. I think that's a film for men to watch and let their emotions out.
Do men really cry when watching Point Break?
I've seen men cry watching Point Break.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And that's I think it's like Thelma and Louise for men. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And it's quoted in many films. The guy's saying, remember when we bonded over Point Break?
It's really true.
I wish you could see my face right now. I don't know how. I don't get it.
I don't either. Yeah.
Okay. Explain, please.
It's a love story. It's,
is it?
He
I
loves
so.
Him and he has to let him go, but from two different worlds, it's tragic.
Oh. their love can never be. He's an FBI agent and the other's a bank robber and it just will never work. Oh, that's so sad. You're right. It's devastating, really.
Well, it's before they had the term bromance.
Yes.
It's one of the first true bromances of the modern era.
Yes.
I think one of the very first bromances was Lawrence of Arabia. And certainly Butch and Sundance.
Yes.
You know, those are great bromances.
Yes.
The friendships that happen. And then in regards to Butch and Sundance, they have a tragic ending. With Lawrence of Arabia, it's again two separate worlds. Yeah. They cannot stay friends.
It's true.
You know,
it's
they're true. Torn apart, literally.
Yeah. But I find that fascinating that men cry. I guess it was actually directed by a woman.
Yes.
So maybe she's sneaking it in there. Sneaking the sentimental stuff in there. Typical. But I kind of want to dispel this notion that weepies are for women and that men never cry. And aren't, you know, are constantly, they aren't affected by emotions. They're, purely rational creatures. I just think that's ridiculous.
I think because of the, for lack of a better description, the Kevin Costner films that came along in the 80s and 90s, it has helped there to be more accepted mm-hmm. male weepies,
mm-hmm.
you know, so to for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm.
And more sports films that bond men and or their fathers with sons. Has allowed more of this acceptability or more of a commonplace
mm-hmm.
of it being just another type of film and that they don't have to specify. Because I think if you ask men now, they'll say, yeah, I cry at movies. Whereas if you ask, say, your parents' generation, my parents' generation, then they'll say no.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'm glad to see that is changing, that we can all admit that we all cry. It's a thing. It's a human thing. There's something.
It's a need. It's an absolute need.
I think the release is really healthy and should be. And I think we should absolutely seek it out. That being said, the movies that stereotypically make men cry, I'm thinking of Brian's Song. I'm thinking of Shawshank Redemption. I'm not so big on those films.
Oh, Shawshank, what are you talking about?
I love Shawshank.
Oh my gosh. I know, I love Shawshank Redemption. I love that film.
Okay.
I saw it in a sneak peek at NYU. They brought it there before it was released. And I remember when it came out, it didn't do well. And I was like, come on, this film's got to be nominated for some Oscars. And it was. And then it didn't get a following until afterwards. And now it's ranked number one on IMDb. And
I
think you're wrong.
Okay. There you go. Well, we can. Maybe someone should put it up for the FlixWise Favorites list because it's a movie that I don't have strong feelings about at all, and I'm puzzled by the number one ranking on IMDb. That blows my mind. But there's something about it that really speaks to, I guess, maybe it is just this segment of the population that's really into voting on ranking things on IMDb, but it's certainly, it's a very, very emotional story about male friendship And so maybe it's, I think you're right that movies about friendship and dudes bonding really does get the male tear ducts going. I don't know. But the other big trigger for me, when I see a shot that is so iconic, it just like evokes so much film history. Mm-hmm. And for instance, when I see E.T. fly across the moon in E.T., E.T. and Elliot fly across the moon every time. Like, Steven Spielberg thought of that shot, and now it exists on all of our collective imaginations. And just thinking about that makes me cry.
The shot in E.T. that gets me is when E.T. is pointing to the heart and the head.
Right.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, aside, that movie just makes me cry, period. But
and I think that movie makes guys cry, too.
Oh, yeah. That's one of those where if you don't cry, there might be something wrong with you. That, again, that's another example, like Iron Giant, where there's something so elemental. It touches something so deep within you, and it's so simple, but just our human compassion. Mm-hmm. And again, it's another story of a creature learning about humans and what it means to be human.
And also childhood.
And childhood,
Now, most films usually depict a boy in childhood, but and I've never had a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I find that most films that depict a little girl tend to be stereotyping the little girls, and it's not universal. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's a little boy, it tends to be more universal.
Wow.
So I could always relate to the boys in all these films.
Yeah. Well, that's a shortcoming of the filmmakers, not...
Yeah?
Yeah. but I would say Inside Out is pretty universal. I'm trying to think if there are stories about little girls. There just aren't that many.
Spirit of the Beehive.
Oh, gosh, yes.
And, yeah,
oh.
That's a pretty good crying movie.
Yes. Oh, Spirit of the Beehive. Talking specifically about iconography and what the actual image of film and the power of film. I will admit that movies about the power of film sometimes do get to me. As cheesy as it is.
Well, Cinema Paradiso.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
That's a really good one.
And that's my husband's favorite film. It makes him sob.
Cinema Paradiso. Yeah. I do believe that is a good... Men often, I think, weep at that one, too.
And you were, once again, talking about a relationship between a boy and a father.
Figure. Yes. Well, I'd say the ultimate... One of the ultimate little girl figures, young women in cinema and in literature is Scout. From To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, yeah.
And
see, I can totally relate to that girl.
Yeah.
Tomboy. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And there is one scene in that film that never fails to make me cry. And I know that it's kind of some people do not like the scene at all and have a big problem with it, but it's the scene in the courtroom where the trial has ended. And all of the African Americans are waiting in the balcony for Atticus to leave.
Yes,
and
that
they all
gets me
stand
too.
Up. And Scout is leaning down, looking through the bars. And the gentleman next to her whispers, "Stand up, Scout, your father's passing."
Stand up, Jean Louise.
Stand up, Jean Louise, your father's passing. The reason it makes me cry is because it's the moment where Scout realizes that her father is a human being.
And something more than just her father.
Right. He's more than her dad. He is a man, and he's a righteous man in a lot of ways. A man that a lot of people respect. And that kills me. Kills me.
Mm-hmm.
Every damn
time. Yep, me too.
Every time. Yeah, so I guess we're kind of into our lists at this point, but are there any others that we want to mention?
The Elephant Man, that's probably my go-to.
Ah, the Elephant Man.
If you ever want to see me cry, like, nonstop, there's a bunch of scenes, actually, that do it for me in that one.
That one's too sad, though.
Anne Bancroft, when she comes to meet
John
Merrick, and they're doing the scene for Romeo and Juliet, and she tells him, "You're not an elephant man, you're Romeo." Like,
yes. Oh, that's true. That's true.
There's a few romantic movies. Like I love The New World. There's the scene right near the end.
Yeah, I need to watch it again because now I'm thinking, why didn't I cry? I should have cried. So any more?
Far From Heaven, Brief Encounter.
Far From Heaven, yes.
That one Brief Encounter is one of mine too.
Really? That one does not make me cry.
Really? Far From Heaven or Brief Encounter?
Oh, Far From Heaven makes me cry, but not so much Brief Encounter.
I think like Brief Encounter, in some ways, it's been a little bit usurped by In the Mood for Love in a lot of people's minds. Like that's sort of, it's almost like a remake, and I think it's maybe just a little bit more modern in the ways that people respond to. So
Yeah, I have to say, I think I respond to In the Mood for Love a little bit more. But even that one doesn't make me cry. Just like, I just think it's beautiful. But I guess that's I'm dead inside, I guess. Well, I'm just not.
You haven't lived enough.
I haven't lived, exactly. Yeah. I think, I don't think I'm as moved by romantic stuff.
When you've lived a bit more.
Yeah.
Well, the one really not romantic movie I have on here is The Blair Witch Project.
Yes.
Makes me cry.
That makes you cry? Because of how bad it is?
No, no. When she's in the tent and
she has
she's
snot
saying,
dripping down
you know,
her
I
nose?
Just wanted to apologize to Mike's mom and Josh's mom and my mom. It's all my, like, that breaks my heart. It's, I think that's like one of the most amazing performances I've seen in any film, really.
Wow, that's a good one though. I wish I had more odd choices, surprising choices for things that make me cry. I feel like a lot of mine are very stereotypical.
Yeah, well, you may have some more odd choices that you just don't come to mind.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
A really great list, Martin. And many of those get me, and some of those I just don't get. Makes me wonder about you. But we were talking briefly before we started the podcast, and we were talking about, like, Now Voyager.
Mm-hmm.
Love that film.
Love Now Voyager.
There's so many Bette Davis films that can make you cry. And then, of course, earlier I mentioned the Cyrano de Bergerac. I love the Best Years of Our Lives at the end when Dana Andrews and Teresa Wright finally get together. Ugh, it just kills me.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that for the first time on VHS on a small TV.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend
still
introduced me. It was a guy who introduced me to that film.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
I love The Quiet Man.
Okay.
and this, for I guess, probably because of the sweet story. And then, like we mentioned earlier, some, like, animal films.
You know? That'll, every time, if the dog gets it,
yeah.
Or, you know.
Yeah.
Do you cry when the dog dies?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And yeah. I always cheer when they live.
Okay.
You know, like, I don't know if you saw the Hindenburg, but they had a list of survivors at the end of the Hindenburg. And when they showed the dog, the entire theater erupted.
Yeah.
Like, with cheers. Yay, they didn't kill the dog.
Oh, my God.
One of the rules in filmmaking is don't kill the dog. Yeah.
But filmmakers intentionally break it all the time because they know that the reaction it will elicit. And it's sort
exactly.
of cheating.
Yeah,
a little
exactly.
bit, but
well, and it's so funny when they cheat sometimes, and you're like, "Oh, those bastards!"
Yeah.
I want to say a much harsher word.
Yeah.
They're like, "Whoa, they're totally manipulating me, and it's working."
Yeah.
And you're crying. I get mad at myself.
Yeah. I don't know if I like that feeling where I'm fighting it. Like, you got me. You win this time.
Yeah. But we shall have another day.
Exactly. I think maybe when you get older, your defenses go down. You just let it happen.
Absolutely.
Let it happen.
That's the situation with me. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because I've gone back and rewatched films that didn't make me cry before. Mm-hmm. And I watch it this time. I'm like, what the heck is happening to me?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Any more?
I agreed with so many of Martin's.
Yeah.
I have a feeling I'm going to be agreeing and disagreeing with some of yours.
Possibly. I don't know that mine are that outlandish. I think the end of City Lights kills me. Charlie Chaplin. And really anything with Shirley MacLaine.
Really?
Shirley MacLaine makes me tear up. The Apartment gets me.
That doesn't make me cry.
Really?
It makes me giddy. I'm
really?
So happy.
I'm just so, I get so happy when I see the ending when she realizes that Sheldrake is not the man for her and that the fact the man that is for her is the nice Bud Baxter, and she says, she repeats the line that he tells her, that's the way it crumbles, cookie-wise, that is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of where the thing that I do comes from, by the way. just something about the look on her face, and the way, when she tears up, I tear up. I don't know what it is about her that just triggers it. I'm not sure. And then there's The Children's Hour, which... When I saw it, I think it was in college, and I thought to myself, this is a film from 1960. There's no way this will be anything but totally insensitive and hokey. But by the end of it, when Shirley MacLaine is given her speech, I was sobbing. Totally worked.
You know, what's funny about that film is I actually don't like the film.
Okay.
I like Shirley MacLaine's part. And I love her. But the rest, I don't like Audrey Hepburn in it, and I don't like James Gardner in it, and I'm a huge James Gardner fan.
Okay.
No, I love Audrey Hepburn, but not in that film. And
okay.
I think, like, I don't know, the end of Children's Hour doesn't leave me feeling like I should cry so much as it just sort of leaves me slack-jawed and empty inside.
Yeah.
Maybe. I think the ending itself is very, again, very bleak. But that it's the scene where she's confessing that was like,
that seems good.
Because it's also anytime a character is sort of revealing something about themselves that they're just discovering.
Yeah.
Like in that moment, they're just coming to grips with it, something that's very uncomfortable for them. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that you nailed it. Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. So the ultimate contemporary example of a film that makes everybody cry, and as far as I can tell, this is universal. If you did not cry at this, there is something wrong with you. I know I've said this before, but I think we can all agree, if you did not cry during the first 10 minutes of Up,
you have
a problem. You should seek help.
Oh, you got me. That's right. Yeah. That's. What about you, Martin? You on board with us?
No, sorry.
No! You didn't cry?
You need help, Martin.
Yeah, the beginning of Up, I don't know if it's just because it moves too fast or what.
All right. I my theory has been debunked. I was pretty certain that was a universal.
I thought so, too.
Everyone I've talked to.
I think he's not of this universe.
It must be.
I'm sorry.
Who are we talking to
right now? I don't know.
Now?
I don't know. I'm just going to leave forever.
Yeah, you should.
I must go now. My planet eats me.
And she laughs maniacally.
Oh, goodness. All right. Well, I guess listeners can tell us what they think of our choices. And they can let us know if Up is, in fact, if that's universal.
She's without words.
I can't speak. I cannot speak. There may or may not be a god, but I thought I knew something about the universe. And that is that everybody cried it up. You've shaken me, Martin.
I think the go-to should still be E.T. Iron Giant or one of those. That's should be the go-to cry movie.
Okay, all right. I guess it's going to have to be. But like I said, my teacher's was Bicycle Thief, or Bicycle Thieves, depending, and I didn't cry at that. So I guess there is no universal cry movie. Fascinating.
Or it has yet to be made.
Yes, I guess we should get on that. Now that we've successfully solved California's water crisis with our giant overflowing river of tears, let's close this thing out with a few final notes of positivity. Carrie, what's one piece of pop culture that you've been digging lately?
County fairs.
County fairs. Oh, you already did that one.
County fairs?
You did that one already.
Oh, I thought I did.
You did Renaissance Fair.
I'm on a fair kick.
Fair thing. All right.
My husband and I always go to the San Diego County Fair, and it's in July, and then ends in July, and then we go to the LA Fair in the late summer, and we love it. I mean, it's Americana. It's homespun. It's, you know, you also have all the gadgets and the kooky things. I stay away from the rides because those just look like death traps. But we love the food. I mean, that's the time that we can just gorge.
Mm-hmm. Get you a turkey leg.
Absolutely. But they also have some really interesting things. Usually you get some gourmet stuff there. You usually have tequila tastings.
All right.
And then just all sorts of sights and sounds and people that you wouldn't otherwise be rubbing elbows with necessarily. And the weird little competitions besides the baking and the flowers, they have a competition for place setting.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's bizarrely fascinating. So I just love the fair. I enjoy it very much, and I encourage people to go out there. And it's a pretty good bang for the buck.
Okay, all right. If you like, farm animals, which I do, who doesn't? Martin.
Yeah, I love farm animals.
Okay. I have not seen a farm animal in the last 10 years of going to the fair.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I skipped that part.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
But the baby pigs are so cute. Oh. Piglets.
Makes me think of Charlotte's Web, and then I cry.
I know.
I was going to say, we forgot to mention Babe.
I know, Babe. All right, let's not. Babe, that might be a submission to the FlixWise favorites list. That might be an upcoming one. I don't want to promise anything, but it's a definite possibility. Anyway, Martin, what's one thing that you've been digging lately?
A short documentary called Love Hacking. It's
Love
by
Hacking.
A filmmaker, Jenny Nelson. And it's about a man who makes robots who becomes engaged to a Nepalese woman he met on the internet. And it's like right before he goes to meet her in person. And then it follows him, and it's really sweet. It's very positive.
Yeah, we'll link it in our show page.
Okay.
All right, cool. Sounds good. I have two quick ones. One relates back to our previous subject. It's a podcast called Cry Babies. It's a weekly podcast about the subject that we were just talking about, movies that make us cry, or just basically pop culture, songs, anything that makes you cry. And it's hosted by, I think it's Susan Orlean and Sarah Thayer, I think it is. And, but I'll look that up. And if you're interested in movies, if you're interested in crying as a subject, you might take that podcast. It's on the Wolf Pop Network, which, you know, who isn't? And, but the other thing that I really like that I saw recently is the documentary What Happened, Miss Simone, which is the documentary currently streaming on Netflix about Nina Simone. And it was a huge hit at Sundance. And basically, it takes us through the life of Nina Simone, through her childhood, from her childhood through her most famous and productive years, into her later years, which were notoriously troubled. But what I really like about it is the use of interview archival footage and old interviews to tell the story. So they take old interviews, audio from old interviews, and splice it up so that you get a chronological story. So it sounds kind of like, you know, Simone narrating her own life. And it's sort of similar to the recent Kurt Cobain documentary montage of Heck, where they had hundreds of hours of tape recordings of Kurt Cobain just talking about his life, incidences from his life. And I think it's really powerful when someone who is no longer with us is able to essentially tell their story. It's very powerful, but it's also a little unsettling and troubling because it's their words, but you don't know, it's taken out of context. But nevertheless, I really enjoy listening to it, and it makes me want to tell the story of my life, record it just so future generations can put together a documentary about me, which will no doubt fascinate millions.
And happen. It will absolutely
happen. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what movies, songs, or TV shows smack you in the feels? Well, that's embarrassing. Come tell us about it on our website, flickswise.com. Or you can leave us a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. We can all congregate for a group hug on Twitter. My handle is @flickswise. But before you do all of that, please rate us and leave us a comment on iTunes. Help us stand out in the Apple database. For our next podcast, we actually have a nice change of pace. Our new pace being, of course, very, very fast, because the next Sight and Sound entry is the OG of epic action-adventure films, Buster Keaton's The General. Until then, Martin, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me on.
All right, Carrie, always a pleasure.
Likewise.
All right, take care, everyone.